The Bible reading program for yesterday included Ezekiel 28. I'd like to begin by reviewing part of that chapter today. Most of us probably know from memory what that chapter is about. But Ezekiel chapter 28, I'm going to start in verse 14. God inspired Ezekiel to write, "You were the anointed cherub who covers. I established you. You were on the holy mountain of God. You walked back and forth in the midst of the fiery stones. You were perfect in your ways from the day you were created till iniquity was found in you." In God's church over the recent decades, you probably read or heard this passage many times and noted before that it's addressed to the king of Tyre. A few verses prior to this, he's described as a created being. He's described as a cherub. He's described as one who covered, one who was a covering cherub. That's a clear reference to the pattern God showed Moses for cherubs that covered the mercy seat in the tabernacle. If you think about it, that's an incredible creation. He was, in a sense, a sum of beauty and perfection until, and that's a very powerful word, isn't it? Until iniquity was found in him, till sin was found in him. Verse 16, "By the abundance of your trading, you became filled with violence within." Doesn't say he was violent toward others, but you became filled with violence within. "And you sinned. Therefore I cast you as a profane thing out of the mountain of God." What had been a sum of perfection became a profane thing in God's eyes. And he said, I cast you out of the mountain of God, and I destroyed you, O covering cherub, from the midst of the fiery stones. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor. I cast you to the ground, laid you before kings that they may gaze at you. We're given a little insight here in this passage into the mental state, the nature of the sin of this incredible being. In Luke chapter 10, not going to turn there, but Jesus said in that chapter that he saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. He fell from heaven. Revelation 12 describes a dragon falling from heaven, describes him drawing a third of the stars of heaven. The book of Revelation equates stars with angels. So a third of the angels apparently followed this particular being. And later on in chapter 12, he's described, he's identified. In verse 9, as Satan, he's the one that fell, that took a third of the angels with him. What caused his fall? Why was he cast out as profane? Why did he go from this sum of perfection to something that God despised so much he cast him out from God's throne? Why did this magnificent being go astray? It's not the fact that he traded. He does talk about the abundance of his trading. He did it abundantly. He got involved in trade. I don't know what spirit beings trade on or what they trade in, but he was obviously trading something abundantly, doing a lot of it. That wasn't the problem. Not from God's perspective. It wasn't that he was beautiful and magnificent. God created a lot of beautiful things. Somebody sent me one of these emails that goes around all these beautiful pictures in it from the universe the other day. So I was watching that, I guess it was yesterday morning or yesterday afternoon. Some beautiful things that God's created out in the universe, out in the heavens. Hubble Space Telescope has taken some absolutely phenomenal, beautiful photographs. Make you feel about this small when you realize how tiny our Earth is compared to the sun and how tiny our sun is compared to some of the other huge stars in the universe. But it wasn't his beauty. It wasn't his magnificence. It was not that he had power and prestige, that he was right there at the throne of God. He had access to God. Apparently one of the cherubs that helped cover the throne of God. That wasn't the problem. Those things, just like their human counterparts in this physical life, aren't the problem. There were many people in the Bible, many people of God, who had relatively difficult lives, were relatively poor. There are others like Job, Abraham, David, who had incredible wealth and power. So it's not a matter of physical things. It's not a matter of spiritual things in the sense in the spirit realm that was what corrupted Lucifer. It's not a matter of rich or poor, or powerful or common. The key's in verse 17, where he says, your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. Your heart. It had to do with his mind. That's the Hebrew way of saying it. That word that is translated as heart, L-E-B, lib, or lab, is translated many different ways. It means the center, the core of your being. And many times it's translated as mind in the King James or New King James. The companion passage in Isaiah 14, which I won't turn to, describes this event and lists a number of ways in which Lucifer went astray. 5 times in 2 verses, it emphasizes the word I. You said in your heart, you said in your mind, I will do this, I will do that, I will ascend above the heavens, into the heavens. I'll exalt my throne. I'll sit on the mount. I'll ascend above the clouds. I will be like the Most High. There was a focus in his mind on himself. It was simply a matter of perspective. Satan was beautiful. Satan was rich, or Lucifer, powerful, highly placed in God's spiritual government, apparently given authority over 1/3 of the angels. We assume that because 1/3 of them went with him. So he had a high position of responsibility. Problem was none of those things. The problem was Lucifer's heart, his mind. Lucifer looked at his proverbial glass and said, this thing's half empty. I don't have nearly enough. I need more. I need the throne of God. I need more than what I have. He wasn't satisfied. Do you see the glass half full or half empty? It's a question I think is important for all of us to think about from time to time. Satan looked at all he had and decided, my glass is half empty. I don't have nearly enough. And all of his trading, all of the whatever he traded in, all of the stuff he had wasn't enough for him. He needed more. He needed more in his glass, proverbially speaking, to feel fulfilled. I'd like to talk about our frame of mind today because I think it is so vitally important. The title of the sermon is your glass half full? I'd like you to keep that in mind as we go through the sermon today. How do you look at your life? How do you look at things? Is your glass half full? Our minds are incredible things. They're an incredible blessing from God. It's what sets us apart. The ability to think and reason is what sets us apart from all the other physical creation that God has made. We look at all of the animals, and He created some incredible things. And yet Paul said, without the Spirit in man, under inspiration from God in 1 Corinthians, he said, without that Spirit, we don't understand the things of a man or of human beings. We don't understand human issues without having that Spirit in man. And it is that Spirit that gives us the ability to think and reason. It's what gives us what we call mind, that seat of intellect. And yet it's been difficult for humans or for science to clearly identify that. God tells us what it is. It's the Spirit in man that makes the mind, makes the human brain so powerful. The Bible's not a science text, nor is it a book on philosophy, but we view it as a foundation of all right knowledge. And it has some things to say about our mind and how we view things, how we see things. The Old Testament, the word mind appears about 40 times, about 55 in the New Testament. Other times, you'll find the same word translated as heart, when it obviously is referring to mind. So it shows up quite a bit in the Bible. Our mind is the key battleground for us as Christians, isn't it? I mean, we know that. We're aware of that. But so often, I think we as Christians let that slip out of our mind. That's where our real battle is. It was that way in the first century of the New Testament. It was that way in the Old Testament with the people of God. It was that way before human beings were around. The real battle in Lucifer was what was going on in his mind. Wherever a spirit mind is, I don't know. We assume it's kind of in the head like us. But wherever his mind was, that's where the battle was. It wasn't over the physical or the material or spiritual or whatever things he was trading in. The battle was in his thinking. It was in his mind. And it continues to be the same today and will always be the battleground for God's people. So remind ourselves of that in 2 Corinthians 10. Many of you know that passage by heart, but I want to turn and read it, just to get it back in our minds again. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 1. It says, "Now I, Paul myself, am pleading with you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ, who in presence am lowly among you, but being absent am bold towards you. But I beg you that when I am present I may not be bold with that confidence by which I intend to be bold against some who think of us as if we walked according to the flesh. For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war against the flesh." That's not where our real battle is, even though we live in the flesh. "For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, they're not fleshly, they're not physical, but mighty in God for pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ." The context of this, if you look at the book and look at the surrounding chapters and the verses that follow, the context is that Paul is having to get a little bit strong with the members in Corinth because they were giving esteem to certain local people and yet despising Paul, who was the apostle to the Gentiles. They were allowing their minds to be influenced by Satan, certain imposters in the congregation were being esteemed as leaders, and they weren't showing the respect to Paul that they should have. And Paul got a little strong with them about that. He was the apostle to the Gentiles, the one who had established that congregation, and it had served them well. That's the context of it, but the point is, it was their thinking. It was the way they were running their minds. It was what they were letting their minds feed on that got them steering themselves in the wrong direction, just as Lucifer did. That's where the battle is, brethren. It's where my battle is. That's where your battle is, too, as a Christian. It's in our minds. The point is valid regardless of the context. Our minds are and always will be the battleground where our warfare takes place. As long as we're in this flesh, we're going to be subject to the influences of Satan, the influences of our own human reasoning, the influences of society around us. And we're always going to have to struggle. We're going to be subject to vain arguments that crop up and battle against obedience to God and Christ's instruction about humility, about respect, about service to one another, and having the same frame of mind that Jesus Christ did. That's always going to be a challenge for us. We get so terribly headstrong sometimes as humans. I've often thought about what's the difference between being headstrong and obstinate versus being steadfast, resolute, and unchanging. You know, we're really describing the same thing, aren't we? And yet in some cases we say, well, they're stubborn. You know, you just can't change their minds. What makes the difference is what we're stubborn about, right? If it's God's truth that we don't give up on and won't change on, then it's positive. We're being resolute. We're being steadfast. But if it's something of our own making, it gets a little more into that stubborn side that all of us have to one degree or another. So let's talk a little bit about this mind. Maybe that's why I was struck so much by Proverbs chapter 3. I think I mentioned this. I can't remember if I did it. And I think I did it in services a few weeks back. But let's go back to Proverbs chapter 3. That passage that talks about trusting in God with all your heart, not leaning on your own understanding. So the book of Proverbs is filled with statements like this. Don't lean on your own understanding. Don't lean on what you think you know. I think it was today's English version that said, trust in the Lord with all your heart. Never rely on what you think you know. Don't rely on what the things you think you know are. Only rely on it if it fits with God. with what God says. The verses that follow give such pointed advice as well, verses 6 through 8. In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He'll direct your paths. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and depart from evil. It will be health to your flesh and strength to your bones. Today's English version says, remember the Lord in all you do. He'll show you the right way. Never let yourself think you're wiser than you are. Simply obey God and refuse to do wrong. Sounds kind of stubborn, doesn't it? And yet God is saying, yes, I want you to be resolute in those areas. Those things that I tell you, stick with it. Don't let anybody change your mind on that. Refuse to do wrong. Verse 8 goes on to say, if you do, it'll be like good medicine, healing your wounds, easing your pains. That's being steadfast. That's being unwavering. That's being resolute. Following what God says. Simply obey God and refuse to do wrong. It's been the story of God talking to human beings from the beginning of the Bible, hasn't it? Oh, we can go all the way back to the story of Cain and Abel. Remember his words to Cain back in Genesis chapter 4 when they both brought an offering to God and one God accepted the offering of Abel and he didn't accept the offering of Cain. You go back and look at it and we'll get into the details of it. But verse 6 of Genesis 4 says, so the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? Why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? If you do right, I'm not a respecter of persons. If Cain does right, I'll accept him. If you do right, I'll accept you. If you do right, won't you be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin lies at the door and its desire is for you, but you should rule over it. Cain, sin is right there. It's right there with you. If you don't do well, it's very easy for the mind to start justifying and for you to start reasoning why it was okay for you to do what you did. Cain was told, sin is lying at the door and you've got to rule over it, Cain. We're told the same thing. God hasn't changed His story. He hasn't changed the picture. We all must rule over sin, as God told Cain. And Peter, of course, tells us who the real enemy is. We go to the New Testament in 1 Peter chapter 5. Peter tells us where that pull to do the wrong things comes from. 1 Peter chapter 5. It's interesting to note the comments about humility in verse 6. I'll wait and talk about that a little bit later. But in verse 8 he says, be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Resist him, steadfast in the faith. There's that resolute frame of mind again, isn't it? Obstinate if it's opposite of God, obstinate if it's something of our own making, resolute. Positive when it's following God. Resist him, resist Satan, steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. We all as Christians face the same struggle. We face the same battle. We have the same battleground. And it's right up here between our ears. It's where the biggest battle of our lives takes place. We realize Satan is the source of all wrong thinking. He's the one that started it. We began in Ezekiel 28. That's where wrong thinking got its beginning. If you look at it historically, that's it. It's where it began. It was with Lucifer. He's the one that first started the wrong way of thinking. What does wrong thinking look like? How does it manifest itself? Well, there are many things we could read in the Bible, many things that we could talk about, but I want to look at a few of them today. The things that get us off track in our thinking. So that we're no longer thinking correctly, but we're beginning to think down the path that led Lucifer to rebel against God. That line of thinking is a line of thinking that God does not want to see in His kingdom. He's already dealt with that with Satan. He's already cast Satan out, Lucifer out. He became Satan, the adversary. So what are some of the manifestations of a wrong way of thinking? Well, one of the most obvious is vanity. I mentioned verse 6 says, therefore, humble yourself, right here in 1 Peter 5. Humble yourself under the mighty hand of God. Humility, the opposite of vanity and pride, is a very important part in the way we think. A very critical thing in our thinking. One of the most obvious ways it shows we're getting off track is in vanity, taking pride in ourselves, thinking we're smarter, stronger, better than others. Let me take you back to the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 4. Daniel chapter 4, the story here is about one of the mighty kings of the Chaldean Empire, Nebuchadnezzar. We'll pick it up in verse 28, Daniel 4 and verse 28. It says, all this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of the 12 months, he was walking about the royal palace of Babylon, and the king spoke, saying, is not this great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty? Now you look at, you research what Nebuchadnezzar was talking about, or you research what Babylon was like, and Nebuchadnezzar had reason to be happy with what he had done. I mean, he had taken that city and had built it into a magnificent, incredible place. It was one of the wonders of the ancient, a marvel of the ancient world. Nebuchadnezzar lived in the 500s B.C. He had enlarged the city. He had added a lot of incredible things to that city to make it a beautiful place. He added magnificent buildings, a number of temples, an incredible palace, which included the famous terraced hanging gardens. Just a wonder of the ancient world. Legend says he built those for one of his foreign wives to remind her of the scenery of her homeland. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. It was just an incredible feat, though, to build those hanging gardens. Herodotus says the city was in the form of a square, 13 miles on each side. Now, I think they've done excavations that show Herodotus was exaggerating a little bit. But it was a big city. It was large. It was huge. It had a double wall, an inner wall, an outer wall. There was a bridge over the Euphrates River joining the eastern and western parts of the city. Excavations, as they say, show that it wasn't quite 13 miles. It was about 11 miles long. That's still pretty big, isn't it? 11 miles square. Huge, huge. The outer wall was 25 feet thick. Just looking here on the wall, I don't know if you can count 25 of those blocks, but about 25 of those blocks thick. Now everybody's going to be looking at blocks on the wall instead of looking. No, that's okay. Count your blocks. Look at how far they are. 25 feet thick. I mean, we're talking about a thick, thick wall. That was the outer wall. And then there was a large area in between. The inner wall was 23 feet thick. And they had a lot of rubble in the space in between. So trying to break through that wall in the ancient world would have been a terribly difficult, almost impossible feat. So Nebuchadnezzar had reason to look around and say, wow, this is an incredible thing. There were watchtowers that rose every 65 feet or so, 8 or 9 gates to the city. The whole wall was surrounded by a moat filled with water from the river. I mean, huge area. Don't we wish we had just a little bit of that water here in East Texas, as dry as it's been? They had from the river this huge moat around this massive city. Some say it was maybe 500,000 people that lived in the city at that time. It wasn't just a little town. We're not talking a little burg. We're talking a massive, incredible city. But Nebuchadnezzar truly was a great administrator and a ruler, but God wasn't impressed, was he? God wasn't impressed with his vanity. Verse 31 says, and while the word was still in the king's mouth, a voice fell from heaven. King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you. And they will drive you from men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. They'll make you eat grass like oxen, and 7 years, I'm going to pass over you. until you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever He chooses. Today we'd say Nebuchadnezzar, old Neb, whatever we wanted to call him, you're a little too big for your britches. A little too much pride. I'm going to humble you, take you down a notch or two, give you a little attitude adjustment, change your thinking a little bit, help you see things from a different perspective. How many different ways can we say it? God said, enough. That's it. And he became like an animal, because God wanted to remind him who was really important. And that was God, not Nebuchadnezzar, not some other human being. God was the one that he should have been praising and thanking. Now, Nebuchadnezzar gives us the conclusion. In fact, he tells us himself why that happened to him. If we look at his words in verses 36 and 37, Nebuchadnezzar says, this is why it happened, because of the way I was thinking. It wasn't right, and God gave me a little attitude adjustment. Verse 36, at the same time, after the 7 years, my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my honor and splendor returned to me. My counselors and nobles resorted to me. I was restored to my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all of whose works are true, and his ways justice. And those who walk in pride, he is able to put down. This is what Nebuchadnezzar says. God is able to put you down. Those who walk in pride. Clearly, Nebuchadnezzar had been walking in pride. Now, as an aside, as I read this story, I think about the Jews who had been taken captive and carried away to Babylon. What kind of an impact did that have on them? Think about how they would have looked at King Nebuchadnezzar. It's quite possible some of those who were carried away to Babylon, some of the Jews, would be thinking, well, God failed to protect us from the power of King Nebuchadnezzar, failed to protect us from the power of their gods. Maybe God's not as strong as he is. Quite possibly they were beginning to see that God is not as great as they once thought. Powerful miracles, and there were a number of them listed in the book of Daniel, had to be a powerful witness to them too, didn't it? Yes, God is the ultimate power in the universe. Maybe their glass was just half full with a God who wasn't strong enough to protect them, and God saying, no, you need to look at it the other way around. I have all the power in the world. That glass is half full, not half empty, and I have the power to protect you no matter what. But because of your rebellion, I've allowed you to go into captivity. I'm still in control, but I've allowed you to go through some of the things that you've done. Some of the things that you have because of what you've done. I read a story some time ago on sermonillustrator.org about a famous coach who took a vacation with his family, went into a small town and walked into a movie theater and sat down. And when they sat down, there was a handful of people applauded. He goes, wow, even way out here in the middle of a little podunk town in Maine, people know who I am. And then somebody walked over to him and said, by the way, thanks for coming in. They won't start the movie with less than 10 people. The article went on to say that can deflate an ego in a hurry. The trouble with thinking you're someone important is that not everyone is as convinced as you are. They just wanted bodies so they would start the movie. And here he thought they were applauding him. There are many other proverbs and other places we can go, but I'd like to turn to Proverbs chapter 16, look at a couple of things it has to say about pride. That's a part of wrong thinking. It's a part of looking at things from a wrong perspective, from the perspective that Satan began to take. Proverbs chapter 16, verses 18 and 19, says this, pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. We just read that with King Nebuchadnezzar, didn't we? It was his pride that led to his fall. Better to be of a humble spirit with the lowly than to divide the spoil with the proud. humble spirit. That's the right way of thinking. That's the right perspective. That's the right way to view life. It's the right way to view your glass from God's viewpoint. A few chapters later, over in chapter 18, we're told that before destruction, the heart of man is haughty, and before honor is humility. The two are contrasted. Haughtiness is going to bring you down sooner or later. Humility, and God can honor you. God can work with that. Here in chapter 16, a few verses later, after what we read in verses 18 and 19, verse 25 says this, "There is a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death." Might seem right to be proud about what you've accomplished and begin to think of yourself a little more highly than you should, but where does that end? The same disastrous ending as it did with Lucifer. None of us wants that ending. None of us wants to go there. So it means we better control what goes on here in our mind, right? Better control our thinking. Comes back to the statement of not relying on what you think you know and thinking you're wiser than you are. Just humble yourself before God. Do what God says. Do it God's way. And God will bless you. That's sometimes hard for us as humans, isn't it? Let's talk about another manifestation of wrong thinking, of looking from the wrong perspective, looking at things from the wrong viewpoint. In Luke chapter 17, we read about another perspective that is wrong, another tell for wrong thinking, and that's ingratitude. Luke chapter 17, we're told a story. And by story, I don't mean something made up. We're told a true story, one of the events that happened in the life of Jesus Christ. Luke chapter 17 and verse 12 says, "Then as he entered a certain village, there met him 10 men who were lepers who stood afar off. And they lifted up their voices and said, 'Jesus, Master, have mercy on us.' So when he saw them, he said to them, 'Go show yourselves to the priests.' And so it was that as they went, they were cleansed, and one of them, when he saw that he was healed, returned, and with a loud voice glorified God." I'll stop for a minute here and point out, Jesus told them, go do what the law says you should do in the Old Testament. Said you should go talk to somebody, go show yourself to the priest, go see someone to be able to be allowed back into society. So you're no longer an outcast. I know you're healed. I'm healing you. But you need to go through the proper channels so you can be accepted back in society. And as they walked along, they were healed. And one, when he saw that, returned, came back with a loud voice and glorified God. Verse 16, fell down on his face at Jesus' feet, giving him thanks. And he was a Samaritan. So Jesus answered and said, "Were there not 10 cleansed? But where are the 9? What's wrong with the thinking of these other 9? Where are they? Were there not any found who returned to give glory to God except this foreigner?" And he said to him, "Arise, go your way. Your faith has made you well." Out of the 10 lepers Jesus healed in this instance, only one expressed his gratitude. Only one. And that happened to be a foreigner, Samaritan. One of those worthless people. I mean, that's the way the Jews looked at them. Samaritans, I mean, they're nothing. Peons. They're not worth anything. And yet it was that individual who had the heart, who had the way of thinking that God was looking for, came back and expressed his appreciation. Luke's the only gospel writer that records this. The others apparently took their healing for granted. This one showed appreciation. In 2 Timothy chapter 3, we are told a prophecy about what it's going to be like near the end time. God inspired Paul to write this. And the lack of thankfulness, ingratitude, plays a part in what he described in the generations near the end. 2 Timothy chapter 3, beginning in verse 1. It says, "Know this, that in the last days perilous times will come." And we look around, and every week we look at the news, and there are some perilous things happening. The world is an unsettled place right now, financially, economically, militarily, politically. I mean, it's unsettled all kinds of ways. But he wasn't talking just about physical in that sense. It's perilous for other reasons as well. It's perilous because of the way people are and the way they think. Because actions follow thinking, don't they? Because, why will they be perilous? Verse 2, because, or 4, men will be lovers of themselves. Lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. It's a pretty powerful list, isn't it, of what people are going to be like as we come to the time of the end. Now, it's easy for us to sit here today and say, yeah, but we're the church of God. That's talking about all them, all of those people out there. But as I read a list like this, I always ask myself, does this describe me in any way? Am I letting any of the thinking, if that's what out there is like, am I letting any of the out there begin to influence my thinking, my mind, the way I look at things? I think all of us need to view these kinds of passages that way. Does this apply to me? Am I beginning to find myself thinking the way these individuals obviously are thinking? Unthankful. Not being grateful. One of the keys here is that people are not grateful or thankful for what they have. They're self-absorbed. They're lovers of themselves. Excluding others. Paul expressed it that way. We'll talk about that next. First, let's focus on the lack of gratitude. Lack of appreciating what we have. The lack of appreciating we even have a glass and that we have a little bit of water in it. If the glass is half full. Yeah, I'm talking reality-wise. If it were half full, how do you view that glass? Are you grateful you have a glass? Are you grateful you have something to drink out of? Are you grateful you have some water in there? That it's not just filled with sand or dirt? How do we view things? Do we appreciate what God gives us? Water is that essential liquid, essential tool for life. Without it, we don't live. You know, my mom was talking to her again this morning. She's a little worried about her well, whether her well is going to run dry or not. Her neighbor's been pumping lots. He's down at the same level she is, and he's pumping lots of water on his trees, trying to keep his trees from dying. She's pumping water on her foundation, trying to keep the foundation from cracking. She said, "We're sucking so much water out of there, it's going to run dry if we're not careful." Water is required for life. When we have a glass, are we grateful that there is a half a glass of water? Are we thankful for it? Ephesians chapter 5, Paul wrote to us. He addressed it to the church at Ephesus, but God saw fit to record it for you and me and every Christian that's lived between them and us and every Christian who will live after us. It's written for all of us. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 18. Let's start there. I'm breaking into the thought because it begins with the word "and." Obviously, he's given some other instructions, but in verse 18, he begins this thought or this focus. Ephesians 5:18, "And do not be drunk with wine, in which is dissipation, but be filled with the Spirit." If you want to be filled with Spirit, don't make it distilled alcohol. Make it the Spirit of God. Different kind of Spirit. Not alcohol spirits. Be filled with the Spirit of God, speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord, giving thanks always. How often? Always. Sometimes that's hard for us, isn't it? Now keep in mind, who's writing this? Man who's in prison. When is he writing it? When he's in prison. Give thanks always for all things to God the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. Paul wrote to Ephesus when he was in prison. More specifically, he was under house arrest in Rome, as we understand the timing of it. He had spent 2 years in prison in Jerusalem and Caesarea. Then he had his famous boat ride to Rome, shipwrecked along the way. A little bit more adventuresome than he wanted, but God protected him. God brought him to Rome, and he spent a couple of years in Rome under house arrest. They had been in prison in Jerusalem and Caesarea. He knew what it was like to be in prison. And he said, give thanks always. Be grateful. Be thankful for what you do have. He said, if you're filled with the Holy Spirit, it's going to lead to doing that, no matter what your circumstances. And be grateful for what God does give you, what He has given you. Seeing the glass half full, focusing on that, on the positive side of it, is an important part of being a Christian. It's so easy for us to complain as Americans, isn't it? We have so much, and yet it's easy to complain. Don't like to drive to Tyler, don't like to sit in a gym, don't like to sit in uncomfortable chairs. As an aside, I am going to talk to them about the chairs. When we first talked to the guy who was here beforehand, we talked about that possibility, that if we were going to be here regularly, they would get a little more comfortable chairs for us. So we'll work on that. And then I read articles of people in Africa who are grateful just to have a little piece of tin to shield them from a little bit of the sun and happy to have logs to sit on. And I think, yeah, I'm spoiled. I really am. I'm spoiled. I'm used to having things nice in here in the United States. But again, what's our perspective? We're so blessed as Americans, so used to being comfortable, that it's easy to slip into a wrong way of thinking, of not being grateful for what we do have, and to only look at that half of the glass that's empty and wish we had that half glass filled with water also. I ask you, was that not the very thing that Lucifer did that got him kicked out of the government of God, the garden of God? He didn't have enough. Our whole society seems to be geared toward wanting and feeling that we deserve more than we have. In 1 Timothy chapter 6, and I'm with you. I mean, the chairs are not the most comfortable. I mean, my back's already bothering me, and trying to sit in that chair was a little difficult too when your back's hurting. So I understand. The point is, do we let it get to us, and does that begin to affect our thinking? In 1 Timothy chapter 6, God inspired Timothy to write this, beginning in verse 6. Now, godliness with contentment is great gain. And it's not saying be content with every horrible thing in your life. If you can improve it, do it. But godliness with contentment, do it in a godly manner. Do it thinking the right way. Being grateful that you do have what you have. If you can do better, do better. But his point here is, for we brought nothing into this world, and it's certain we can carry nothing out. As the old saying goes, there's no hearse that has a U-Haul attached to it. I mean, you can't take it with you. You know, we hauled a U-Haul camp, but you know, the hearse doesn't carry one. I mean, you can't take anything with you. You brought nothing in, you can take nothing out. In verse 8, and having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. Again, not that we don't look to better yourself if you can. If you do it the right way, by hard work, by looking for ways to do better, that's fine. If you've never traveled outside our nation, I think you've missed a great lesson. You can learn it from listening to others. I'll have to say the first-hand experience really teaches you more about how spoiled we are as Americans. I really, really treasure the opportunity to go to the Philippines because it was a wonderful experience to recognize people who have so little can read these verses and say, "That's how I look at the glass. I'm grateful for the little drop of water I have in the glass. Grateful to have a glass. Grateful to have a drop of water. Grateful that it's not totally empty." You know what they're most grateful for is they're grateful for their understanding of this, God's truth. They recognize the value of this that sometimes I think we in America begin to take for granted. What else? Need to move along here. I said we'd talk a little bit about selfishness. Let's do that. Matthew chapter 22. Matthew chapter 22. Jesus made a statement in this passage that, again, is a famous passage, one that we probably memorized. Matthew 22 and verse 35, one of them came, who was a lawyer, and asked him a question, testing him and saying, "Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law? What's the really big, big questions. We're talking big stuff. What's the big, what's the great law? What's the great commandment in the law?" And Jesus said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind." Everything, all of our thinking should be directed toward God, should be directed toward God's way of doing things. From God's perspective, this is the first and great commandment, and the second is like it. "You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." He wasn't separating them. He said, these go hand in hand. John later said, if you say you love God and you don't love your brother, you're a liar. Those are God's words, not mine. They are equal, God says. Love your neighbor as yourself. Love God first and foremost with all your heart, soul, mind, and being, but love your neighbor as yourself. It's not a small matter. It requires us to think of other people. And we can think of ourselves too and our needs, but God's way of thinking means we think of others also. We consider them. We don't just look at our own needs. We're not just self-absorbed. We're not just lovers of our own selves, as we read in 2 Timothy 3. What are the results of selfishness? What are the results of people who don't think of others? Oh, there's a whole long, long list. You don't treat others like you want to be treated. Remember the golden rule? We don't do that when we're self-absorbed. We're only concerned about ourselves, not the good or the thoughts and feelings of others. Those kinds of thoughts lead to graft, corruption, con artists, misleading financial statements, and other ways of falsely getting from others. Look at the economic mess our country is in. And a lot of it came because of greed, because of selfishness. Looking to get from others, getting for the self, and not worrying about the consequences for others. Looking for self-gratification, self-satisfaction. I'll share a quote from, it's actually about a decade old now, from movie director Oliver Stone. At that time he said, "We're becoming," speaking about the United States, "we're becoming what the history books tell us late Rome was like, mired in decadent self-absorption and lacking virtue." It's a pretty powerful statement. Mired in self-absorption. Our nation is almost obsessed with self-esteem and feeling good about ourselves. And I'm not against being positive in that area also, but putting self at the center of everything is not a godly way of thinking. God says, think of others as well. Philippians chapter 2. Let's turn there quickly. You know the verse, you know the statement that says if we have the mind of Christ, if we let that mind of Christ be built in us, we won't be thinking that way. It won't be self-absorbed. It will be thinking of others as well. In the first verse of chapter 2, Paul talks about if there's any consolation, if any comfort of love, if any fellowship in the Spirit, verse 2, fulfill my joy by being like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord, of one mind, let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit because you think of yourself as a great person or a high person. Don't do anything that way. Nothing out of selfish ambition to raise yourself at the expense of others. But in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. Let each of you look out not only for his own interest. I mean, we're going to do that as human beings. We look out for ourselves. But not only that, but also for the interests of others. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. And he goes on to talk about Jesus Christ's perspective. He was willing to come and die for you and me and all humanity. Not to benefit himself, but because he cared for others. We're to care for others too, not just ourselves. And doing so is to allow God's mind to be formed in us, to see things from God's perspective, to see the glass the way God wants us to see it, to be grateful for what we do have, even if it's only half a glass. Before we close, I'd like to go back to the book of Proverbs. We started in chapter 3. I'd like to go next to chapter 4, Proverbs chapter 4. Because there's an important part that has to do with how we live our lives if we're thinking correctly. It follows on what we read in chapter 3 in terms of trusting in God, looking to Him, walking in His ways, not trusting our own minds, not trusting our own thinking of things. But in Proverbs chapter 4, beginning in verse 20, he says, "My son, give attention to my words." And in essence, this is God speaking to all of us, sons and daughters. "Listen to what I have to say. Incline your ears to my sayings. Do not let them depart from your eyes. Keep them in the midst of your heart. For they are life to those who find them and health to all their flesh. Keep your heart with all diligence, for out of it spring the issues of life." I'll pause there for a moment and say in verse 23 here, this in the today's English version says, "Be careful how you think. Your life is shaped by your thoughts." Out of it comes spring the issues of life. Your life gets shaped by your heart. It's that Hebrew word lib or lab. It's pronounced, I think, L-E-B. And it does mean the heart, the mind, the will of a person. And the way we think shapes our life. We can think positively. We can think negatively. It will shape our life. "Put away from you a deceitful mouth and perverse lips far from you. Let your eyes look straight ahead and your eyelids look right before you. Ponder the path of your feet. Let all your ways be established. Don't turn to the right or the left. Remove your foot from evil." How we run our mind is going to determine how we live our lives. I want to read those last few verses again in today's English version. Again, be careful how you think. Your life is shaped by your thoughts. Never say anything that isn't true. Never have nothing to do with lies or misleading words. Look straight ahead with honest confidence. Don't hang your head in shame. Plan carefully what you do, and whatever you do will turn out right. Avoid evil and walk straight ahead. Don't go one step off the right way. Keep on the right path. Isn't that describing a life of integrity, of righteousness, of living the right way, of living by God's instructions? These verses are all about integrity, living God's way, because we think God's way is right, because we're grateful that God has given us instruction of life. And we listen to that. It's what's called a life of righteousness. Proverbs chapter 14, verse 34 tells us that righteousness brings wonderful blessings, living that life of integrity and righteousness. In fact, here it says, it even exalts a nation. Proverbs chapter 14 and verse 34, "Righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people." Righteousness exalts a nation, or a church, or even a family. We've said it for years in our camp program, trying to get this into the minds of our young people. But it needs to be in our minds as well. God's way works. And it works best because He's the one that created life. It's His way, not our way. On a note that relates to us somewhat internally here in the Church of God, I would ask that you be praying for the outcome of the selection of our ministerial board of directors. Pray that God gives all of us sound minds, minds that will listen to Him and that will see things from His perspective. That we'll get our thinking straight, realize what matters much and most is not so much what's written on a piece of paper of our own physical bylaws and constitution and governance structure. It's not the most important thing. What's most important is what goes on right here in our minds. It's how we look at things. That's going to determine whether we're successful or not. And it's how I think, it's how every other elder thinks, and it's how you think that's going to determine whether we're successful or not in serving God, in serving God's people, and teaching the truth of God, spreading that gospel message of timeless truth to the world. And whatever ways God allows us to. God has blessed us greatly to this point in our very short existence as a group. Don't let Satan, and I'm talking to myself too, don't let Satan swoop in, begin to get our thinking steered the wrong way, to get self-absorbed, to start looking at the glass from the wrong perspective. Be grateful for what God has given us. There's a great battle going on. It's being waged, has been being waged in our minds, and will continue to be waged in our minds. And this sermon's not about the governance. That's just a little side bit. This has to do with our life as Christians. That battle that's being waged doesn't involve tanks or missiles. If we control our mind to not get zeroed in on vanity and pride, to not get into a frame of mind of ingratitude, to not get focused on selfishness, if we will run our minds and focus them on humility, on being thankful, on thinking outside just ourselves and on serving others, God tells us if we do that, if we give to others, He'll give back to us. In fact, He'll give back so much that our cup is going to be overflowing. The glass isn't going to be just half full. It's going to be so full of water, it's overflowing. That's a promise from God, from Jesus Christ. Turn with me to Luke chapter 6, and we'll close here. Luke chapter 6. You know the scripture. You've probably read it many times. But think of it from this perspective. Think of it from the perspective of how do you see your glass? Is your glass half full? Or is your glass half empty? Luke 6, verse 35 says, "But love your enemies, do good and lend, hoping for nothing in return." Now, if that's not outward thinking toward others instead of selfish, self-absorbed selfishness, I don't know what is. Think of others. Lend. Love your enemies, hoping for nothing in return, and your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, for He's kind to the unjust and the evil, and the unthankful, I should say, and the evil. Therefore, be merciful, just as your Father also is merciful. Judge not, and you'll not be judged or condemned, or condemn not, and you'll not be condemned. Forgive, and you'll be forgiven. Give, and it will be given to you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over will be put into your bosom. For with the same measure that you use, it will be measured back to you. These are powerful instructions from God through the mouth of Jesus Christ, God in the flesh, when He tells us that it describes a mindset. It's not a mindset that comes easily to the carnal mind. It's not the normal way of thinking for us as carnal human beings. But brethren, we've been given God's Holy Spirit to help us think differently. Let's all use that Spirit to help us see, to help us see from the perspective that God wants us to see from.